Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
All right, well, I think we'll just kick off. Well, look, 24 albums, countless collaborations, 38 years on the killing floors of show business. But surely this, Elvis Costello, is the highlight. The killing floors. Surely this is the highlight. The Word podcast.
Yes. It finally arrived.
Locked in an airless room with Hepworth.
Exactly.
This is what it's all been leading up to.
It has. Well, happy days. Well, it's lovely to see you. And this is a
good
fantastic
to see you
book.
Too.
And
thank you.
The question we normally ask in Word in Your Ear podcast is what was the music that you can remember listening to in the house where you grew up? Because this is going to be a key part of this conversation.
That's what I spent a lot. That's why the book is as long as it is, because I sort of had to write about all those memories. I mean, in a nutshell, I'd say that, you know, your parents, I don't know, no, somebody's parents, certainly a few of my friends' parents, we're knocking on the bedroom door saying, turn that bloody music down. And my dad's in the front room learning the same music to sing on the radio. And that sort of changes everything a little bit, because that's what he did. He sang on the radio and in the dance hall. And a lot of that was because of the years we're talking about, involved learning hit parade tunes, however inappropriate they were for somebody singing in front of a Glenn Miller-style dance band, you know.
There's a lovely bit where he has to, in 1 week, he has to do My Boomerang Won't Come Back.
Oh, he did.
And also See Emily Play by Pink Floyd.
Well, not the same week, obviously. But my shelf of singles as a boy was obviously the ones I bought with my pocket money, the same as any kid. But I had all these extra records because my dad brought home stacks of them every week in the early 60s particularly, and mid-60s. I had no control over what he was given. Once I realized that was a source of free records, I'd keep my fingers crossed that he got detailed to sing my favorite hit from the charts. But, I mean, sometimes it would be My Boomerang Won't Come Back, and I have that single, so I know he sang it.
No shame.
I mean, at the time, they just had to sing what was popular, because that was the filter at the BBC. Was if you look at the schedules from I've got a clip in from when my dad was first on the radio. My grandmother must have clipped out of the paper, you know. And you look down the schedule of the day, and it begins with the shipping forecast, and then the news, and then somebody playing popular tunes on the cinema organ, then a palm court orchestra, then Mrs. Dale's Diary, and then Joe Loss and my dad's first performance, and so it goes on. And it's
hardly any records.
So of course then the bands were also queuing up to make guest appearances. So when I was a kid, I was just not very far from where we are here. In fact, I just drove by it. The Playhouse Theatre under the arches at Charing Cross was where the Joe Loss Pop Show was broadcast on Friday afternoons, at Friday lunchtime. Whenever I was off school, I'd go with my dad and watch the whole rehearsal. And, of course, as a kid, your dad at work, and two, it was kind of magical, because there's a chance that the Hollies or somebody would walk in carrying their equipment, a bunch of, scruffily dressed lads that probably slept in the van on the drive down from Huddersfield, and then suddenly you see them come in.
Because there's a lovely bit where you're, I think, 1979, and the Attractions are playing the Hammersmith Palais, and you talk about the scent of spilt beer and stale tobacco, and of course the tears of jilted girls.
That was a slightly romantic bit that
it's beautiful.
But it is sort of true, because when I went there I'd been there as a kid.
That's right, you'd watch your father there.
My mum used to get me out of the house by sending me with my dad to work on Saturday afternoons, because the Palais used to be opened up for just maybe 30 patrons on it, I think there were two bands, because they came around on a revolving bandstand. Ray McVeigh sextet was in also. And then, anyway, Joe Loss would revolve into view playing in the mood. And then I'd wait all afternoon to hear my dad maybe sing one song, because they were mostly doing the strict tempo stuff. The main reason why I'd opened up were the competition dancers would practice and knock everybody out the way. And there'd be a few little old ladies dancing together, and a mum teaching her daughter to dance. So it was, when I remember it now, it's kind of a sweet scene. But there'd also be really, really strange, only in England things, like the English Tiddlywinks champions would come and demonstrate in the middle of the dance floor. You know, they'd stop everything and play a fanfare. Now we have the English. You know, and Joel Osborne was great. He would always, my favourite announcement is he would say, "We will now continue with our next number."
That's great.
I've used it a few times when I've been stuck to something.
Not a clue what's going up there.
Yeah, but I now continue with our next number, as if we might continue with our next but three number. You know,
so you, it's one of the important points in the book, isn't it? You kind of grew up with music as a trade, rather than you didn't have the normal stars in your eyes that most people have
because it was kind of mundane, really. You know, when you're watching Dad going to work, and it's a bunch of what to me were middle-aged men reading the paper, and I think still smoking, you know. Almost certainly. The scene, I remember it as if it were that. It may not be, but they were all just chatting away, and then some, you know, Joe would come on and bang in it, and then the music would happen. And the same with the bands. When I saw the bands rehearse, they were just in their civvies, you know. Then they'd go backstage just because they were on the radio.
Put a suit on.
Didn't mean that they wouldn't get dressed. Gino Washington was on the show once. He changed his suit for every number. He came out in a different coloured suit. I file this away. I mean, I file stuff away. That's the nature of my mind. And years later, in 1983, I was on a radio show in Paris with Johnny Hallyday. And they said, you have a live mic so you can talk to Johnny, and then we want you to walk down that catwalk that goes between the two banks of audience and lip sync to your song. I said, on the radio? What is the point of that?
That's absolutely.
And so I lip synced on the radio because they wanted the sound of the crowd mostly going, Johnny, Johnny, Johnny. Yeah. Like, trying to sing every day I write the book, you know, trying to pretend to sing it.
Did it strike you that there was an irony? I don't know what did it strike you at the time, that the success of the Beatles was the group that really inspired you. It sort of, you know, sounded the death knell for your father's own career to some extent, wasn't it?
It actually didn't, in a way, because I think. Because it would have done if it had been the late 60s when radio became, you know, the model it is now, or the model it was, certainly for most of my professional career. But because of the way it was set up, the Beatles publishers were sending their songs. They were submitting their songs to be covered. And that's one of the magical things as a fan and being a Beatles fan club member. My dad would get given these acetate dubs on the Dick James label. They'd come directly from the publisher of songs from the Beatles albums that they were trying to get a few extra pennies of publishing royalties. That's the way it worked. They were working on the model of promote the song, not promote the artist necessarily. The labels on these things, they were pre-printed labels that said Dick James Music, and then there was a space for the sub-publisher, which in this case was Northern Songs. And that was just typed in carelessly. Yeah. And it didn't even say The Beatles, it just said Beatles. And then, but these were songs like Girl and Michelle. So those are songs on Rubber Soul. Yeah. I mean, as late as that, they were still, you know, doing what publishers then did, which was promote. And, you know, my mother had worked in the record shops when the chart was actually one of sheet music. So, you know, and in this... Also, another thing my dad did in the 60s was do cover records that predated the Top of the Pops compilations of sound-alike recordings. And they were recordings done in 9 in the morning. You know, the sort of time we were recording this, sort of 7 a.m., when they could get cheap studio time. And they would do note-for-note knockoffs of current hits, put four of them on an EP and sell them in the petrol station.
Yes.
And it was an Australian entrepreneur that came up with this notion that the song was actually the thing that people were attracted to.
I can remember.
If it sounded sufficiently like the original record, that people would buy it because it was good value for money. So my dad would appear under various aliases, sometimes four artists on the same EP that would all be him doing various takeoffs of these other songs. Yeah. Frank Bacon and the Baconeers, Hal Prince and the Layabouts.
The Baconeers.
Yeah, the Foresters doing their note-for-note knockoff of Peter, Paul and Mary's take on Blowing in the Wind. You know?
There's a little bit where you start your kind of professional career, as it were, and which I wanted more on, actually. And you're talking about playing in, I think it's in Widnes, with a friend called Ian. Was that
right? No, Alan.
Alan. Who, the one who came on and said, great to be back.
Yeah, well, he was great. And you know, he's still playing in Austin, and we reformed our group the other night at a book event in Austin, Texas.
Oh, brilliant.
After 43 years, we played this song I wrote when I was 17, and I brought him out from behind a curtain. You'd think I'd announced the Beatles were reforming the way that people reacted. They never heard us originally. I don't know why they were so excited. But so I think it was just the emotion of it. You know, they could see
he's a professional musician still.
We haven't been in touch for years and years, and of all the things he kept a school book, it actually was, with every gig we did,
right,
every set list, and how much money.
What were you called again?
We were called Rusty.
Rusty.
And we were doing mostly sort of Crosby, Stills and Nash and Birds and,
yeah,
you know, actually basement tape songs. We used to play, we didn't call them that then. There were things like You Ain't Going Nowhere,
yeah,
and Tears of Rage and I don't know, Wooden Ships, and I mean,
oh,
anything,
brilliant,
yeah, down by, and Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere, and just what we liked, you know. We wrote a few of our own songs, which were completely purple 17-year-old poetry, you know, would be. But,
what,
you know, we really
kind of
meant
titles?
It.
Yeah. Do you remember the titles?
Oh, well, I don't know. There were all sorts of titles, weren't there? But we both wrote, one of them turned into the song Ghost Train that I recorded in 1980.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was sort of written from going to the clubs with my dad and carrying his trumpet and his equipment. So I sort of had this romantic, slightly cynical idea of show business then and thought it was above it all. But we actually sent demos out. You know, of course, I knew nothing about tape recorders, so I never cleaned the heads. So when we played the
rusty
demo
tape,
they sounded
cloudy.
A bit rusty.
Yeah, a bit rusty.
It sounded like a Charlie Patton record from 1937.
have you kept all this stuff?
Well,
I
kept the Beatles acetates. I kept,
you've got, you know,
Alan's,
ball,
Alan kept his notebook, and he was good enough to give it to me. I put a few of the pages from it in the, what do they call it, the electric book. We couldn't do a steam book. The electric book of this. Yeah. It has some images in there. And, you know, there's one where we were played with the Natural Acoustic Band, which was a big thrill. Remember them?
Yeah.
And we played with them at Quarry Bank School, which was,
yes,
of course,
oh,
again,
fantastic.
It was a big thrill. It was like, we're playing John Lennon School.
I know.
Well, it'd be a rough ass sort of school. And when we get there, it's a nice middle-class college with trees around it.
It is,
like,
now.
Well, no, it was then.
Actually, maybe it was then.
I think it was,
true,
actually. Yeah, whereas I was going to this, you know, Victorian monstrosity in the centre of town, which was much less.
See,
welcoming.
You were definitely at that time. You were kind of on the folk circuit, weren't you? Was,
yeah,
is kind
I
of
used to get thrown out of folk clubs for trying to play my own songs.
Right.
You probably remember that.
So
much like traditional and modern jazz, my dad got punched by a local trad jazz player for trying to borrow his trumpet mouthpiece.
I wanted to just.
I used to
about
get thrown out the door for trying, yeah, to sing my own bedroom ditties in a place where you were supposed to be singing a wailing song, you know.
But did that help you? Discipline?
Made me angry, Dave.
Did it?
No,
truthfully,
we started up our own clubs. That's the only way we could get the music that we wanted to play on. And excuse me. Funnily enough, my mum and dad had done the same thing in, you know, about 49, 50 in Liverpool. Me and Alan and a few other pals, we had one fella that used to run club nights wherever he could get a venue, you know. And the whole door would be £5, which had to be divided up,
yeah,
between everybody that played and probably some money you had to give the venue. So nobody was making any money, but we were learning how to play. That,
right,
was all it was about, really.
What was it that excited you about these various groups that you Joni Mitchell you write about a lot, and the Grateful Dead, and the Peter Green? You wonder a bit, you say he
Peter
among
Green,
us, but not above us.
Yeah, funny. That was the way the voice strikes me now when I listen to it. But I mean, it's a funny song to be your first song as Man of the World, because it's very,
yeah,
complicated. But for whatever reason, I was moved to learn that one in a way that I hadn't been moved to learn much simpler songs. I just loved listening to them, and I never really picked them apart. Somebody had written out these chord symbols, and I struggled for weeks and weeks until I could play it fluently.
Because, yeah,
by the time I'd mastered it, I'd mastered so many chords. I had half the chords that were in my, you know, my first 20 songs. You know, it was then I realized all these other songs were actually easy. It's a funny way around to have done
but
it was just that one song just meant so much to me. I had to learn it. I don't know why.
I get the feeling that you were really into that in the early 70s. You're really into that kind of Warner Brothers. You know, Ry Cooder, Randy Newman.
Well, I think
Bonnie
there were two
Raitt.
Choices. You know, don't you think there were two? There was two ways to go. I went to my parents had separated in the early 60s, but my dad was always around, so I never, you know. But in 70, my mother and I actually moved to Liverpool, and when I went to school there for my last 2 years, it was a very different culture. You know, I went to school in Hounslow. Everybody listened to Motown, Chartbusters, and Rock Steady. You,
yep,
know, those Trojan compilations,
yep,
that's what we had at parties. And I might have been listening to David Ackles and Joni Mitchell in my bedroom, but I never said that to anybody. When I went to Liverpool, you're trying to fit in, and I'm like, I can't listen to Deep Purple and Pink Floyd. It's awful. You know, everybody liked that.
That's
psychedelic
true.
Music's always been big in Liverpool. People liked all this long, the whole, yep, sides of a piece over a whole side. I'm not going to listen to that. And eventually persuaded a few of my mates to listen to Joni Mitchell. And, you know, we'd go on the train to Manchester early in the morning and buy tickets, because a lot of the big tours didn't come to Liverpool. They would come only as 40 miles away, you know. So, yeah, that's what I was listening to. And it was like, and then playing the guitar, those songs seem more achievable somehow. The thing it did do was trick me into thinking that singing intimately would naturally still people in the room, because that's what I'd seen all these people admired. They commanded a room with a confidential style.
Yeah.
But it was, of course, they'd won the right to do it that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they were famous, and that part of it sort of escaped my notice.
So when
I started to sing these the same intimate way Jackson Browne or somebody did, you know, because it didn't work. It took me until it took me to about 75 to realize I had to, my natural voice was louder.
Right.
So I kind of realized if I sang up, you know, sang out a bit more, and I suppose the whole experience made everything, and just this coincidence of having this big gap in my teeth made everything sort of sound like I was spitting it out anyway. The minute I started singing loud, people would jump out of their skin because it was like, what's that, you know.
I'm intrigued, though, about the, you know, when you come to prominence, 76, 77, you kind of have to deny all that stuff, don't you?
But everybody did. I mean, look at Joe Strummer, you know, no Beatles, no Stones. Whatever that
Johnny Rotten was. Johnny Rotten was told by Malcolm McLaren not to talk about Van de Graaff generator and how much he liked
it. I'm sure there was a lot of that. I don't know whether it was Jake or somebody else saying to me, there's journalists getting on the bus on the stiff tours, they'd take that George Jones cassette off, you know, because it would just confuse people. And it was about getting you had 2 seconds to get your story over. So all those early interviews I did, first couple I was just nervous and surly because I wasn't sure of myself. Then I got drank a mind-bending amount of Perno to do one particularly famous interview. And
was that with Nick Kemp?
Yeah,
the garden at the Cross Keys.
Probably around the corner from Ireland on the day
I was in the garden.
We did our debut, and I was
You played that show in the
basement. We played the show, and so we'd got wound up to do the show. Yes. And adrenaline rush, you know, and then a ton of Perno on an empty stomach.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nick was, you know, much more a rock star than I'll ever be. You know, he had his tackle hanging out of his trousers, and the old bony fingers and everything. He looked like a member of the New York Dolls or something. But and I was just there in my cheap suit that I had, you know, and that somebody had given me. I didn't even have any clothes. I had one pair of shoes. I mean, it sounds like I lived in a shoebox, but it was true. I had no money at all.
Right. There's a brilliant
I was living off the royalties from the Wild Whites Camel.
Yeah.
I really was. It saved Christmas. It was so like a Dickensian scene.
Kind of overdid the aggression in that.
I didn't think I was. But you see, my natural disposition is argumentative. I knew that. So it just sounded that way. And it is this thing. You can hear it even in here. I can hear it. The air shoots through. And I mean, this sound. And that's part of the, you know, the effect of me, the way I sing and the way I sound. So,
but at the end of the book,
the face doesn't help.
It's really interesting because you're looking back, and it's interesting that you wrote the book at the age you are. And had you written it any earlier, you might not be able to make sense of your early self. But you talk a lot about the hot-headed character that you were in 1977.
Yeah, but I'm not trying to deny it because
I'm not suggesting it's great, but
the songs have stuck around, and it is amazing.
But why
of songs
do you think? What made you so hot-headed and aggressive in those interviews? And you know, you talk about your you take the piss out of yourself and talk about your show-off rhymes and quips of those days. But
well, that's a little bit later on. That's when I started to think, well, make sure you don't get trapped by this, you know. And then I realized that actually some of the things that are in the songs were being bent out of shape by people taking just those snappy little kind of one-liners that I'd thrown out.
Like what?
And making it all about that. What kind of
one-liners do you mean?
No, the whole revenge and guilt thing, just boiling it all down to that, didn't really reflect what was actually being said in the songs. See a picture in 1,000 places because she's this year's girl.
Yeah.
You think you all want little pieces of this year's girl. Forget your fancy manners. Forget your English grammar because you don't really give a damn. It's not saying anything about the girl. It's saying everything about the way we're looking at the girl. I'm not trying to retrospectively change it, but it's actually not, and it never was the other way around.
No, I understand that, but obviously
of course, if I say it emphatically enough, you think I'm saying it at the girl, at her expense. I'm saying it at you. I'm saying it at myself.
Yeah. But the attractions, I mean, you must have been frustrated also by the fact that a lot of the other groups in the charts at the time had nowhere near the level of musical sophistication.
I think that probably... You know, I don't know. You'd have to take it up with those guys. But, I mean, I couldn't play, you know, really. But, you know, I just played what was needed. the other guys could play. You know, it was like an unusual band. A lot of English bands are like that, configured in a funny way.
Yeah.
Where they're not all playing the conventional roles of the band.
Yes.
Like the Who, you know, the guy soloing in the middle on the drums. Like,
on the drums and on the bass,
Yeah, and we were a bit the same. You know, me and Pete were kind of laying it down, and the other guys were off on their own trip, and it was fantastic. For as long as that worked, it was a very original sound, and then it stopped working, you know.
So. I remember those Sunday evening shows at the Nashville, and my main memory is you used to effectively run on stage.
Mm-hmm. We were told to run.
Start straight away.
Yeah.
And then pretty much run off at the end. Yeah. You know, it was as if
we had about 45 minutes worth of music, and we could get it down to 35 on a good night. 25 sometimes, if we really... Got to hurry up.
I think you got a quote. Bruce Springsteen asks you at one point in the book, how do you get this year's model to sound so good?
No, that My Aim Is True. He was
My Aim. Sorry,
I think
My
he was making Darkness, and that sounds like it was mixed by somebody with cotton wool stuff in their ears. It's a terrible sounding record. Great songs. I'd seen him play them live, and they sounded amazing.
And you said that the reason it was
just no money. Well, we were in a cheap studio, and that's what that was. We didn't have any option.
Yeah,
I mean, we couldn't get far enough away from each other or from the sound that we were creating to have any sort of second thoughts. So. And I didn't actually, in retrospect, I don't actually think that My Aim Is True is really record making. It's a picture of people playing in a room, but it happens to be me and Clover. I had good songs and they could really play. Watching The Detectives is the first piece of record making where the sound is sort of part of the story as well, with all these kind of
absolutely
pictorial gestures on the instruments, you know. And then once we got in with The Attractions, then we did things instinctively in response to the songs, you know. And I think some of the time the guys would I'd give them a riff and they'd syncopate it, and that would become like Chelsea is like that, you know. Pete was playing the drum part from Fire by Mitch Mitchell. I didn't find that out until about 4 years ago, you know. He never said that at the time. I mean, it was like when I worked with Roots.
Lucky the press never got hold of that.
We would have been all over. He's copying Mitch Mitchell.
Mitch Mitchell.
No, and I think it was the Stephen Mandel who's engineered the third producer of Wise Up Ghost, who works with Questlove. He said, you know, Questlove's the way that Pete plays that Fire riff. What are you talking about? You know, and
it's only when somebody else hears it.
It's funny when somebody else hears it. You know, they spot the quotation. You know,
I must just ask about the fact that you're in this extraordinary position of being enormous fan of people like Burt Bacharach, Paul McCartney, and Bob Dylan. And you finish up working with them, collaborating with them in incredible, unusual, unique, and intimate circumstances. Mm-hmm. What did you learn from working with those three people? Extraordinary things happening. Give us some examples of things you understood about them or understood about, about being a musician at that level.
Well, technical things. I suppose it's certainly with Paul McCartney and Burt Bacharach. It was that their strict adherence to the melodic shape, the rhythmic. You know, it's they wouldn't cheat at the end of a line, add a sort of like, you know, a couple of notes on the end of a line in order to get a good rhyme to work, or a pickup note into the bar, if you know what I mean. It was like and you know. They wouldn't do that. They once the melody was set, that's the melody. So you had to use just that amount of space to say what you're going to say, which drives the lyricist crazy because you see all these possibilities of a way to say something, but you lack like one sort of tiny beat, tiny one accent that you're not allowed to make use of. And of course, when I write my own lyrics for my own songs, I cheat shamelessly in that manner.
Yeah, of course.
Which means that a lot of my verses are different proportions and have these funny little asides, which makes them tough to memorize, but... So I learned that. I mean, I didn't really think I was learning anything really while I was doing it. I was just trying to write some good songs.
There's a lovely bit where you're talking to Bob Dylan, and Bob Dylan says, "So watching The Detectives, was that a real cop
show?" Such a good impersonation. Yeah. I thought it was him.
It's uncanny.
Normally, all Mark's impressions are George Harrison.
George Harrison. That's the only accent I can do is George Harrison. But then you said, "What did you say?" I can't remember.
I didn't say that out loud. That's what I thought. Because he was obviously teasing me out that I would imagine, you know. I don't think you're really curious, but I noticed that some people turn up in the book now and again, but I haven't put them in there to say, look, I am their equivalent. I put them in there because there's different times our paths crossed as I was going along in my career, And I go, bloody hell, you know, here I am talking to this person whose records I've pondered, and we're having this very bizarre conversation, you know, about one thing or another, you know.
And you were thinking, shouldn't I be asking him where are the gates of Eden?
Yeah.
But Dave was saying a brilliant...
My favourite bit in the book, because I'm a, you know, childhood Beatles fan, like we all are around this table, and it seems to me doing Paul McCartney's songs at the White House seems to me like a dream fulfilment for a 9-year-old Beatles fan.
Yeah.
Just tell people, you know, what that involved.
Well, it first of all involved going to the White House, which was pretty strange. You've got to get in there with all the security and give your passport, and they have to check you out. And then we've already been told that the room that we're playing in, this is on the occasion of Paul getting the Gershwin Prize for songwriting, yeah, which is a very prestigious prize given by the Library of Congress. And I think it's only the third or fourth one that they're given. So we're all there, and the room is only 4 rows deep, so nearly everybody is somebody, you know. And the front row is, on one side is Paul and his then-fiancée, now his wife Nancy, and behind him, Mary and Stella and his brother Mike. And to the other side, President Obama and Mrs. Obama and Mrs. Obama Senior, you know.
Unbelievable.
First lady, the mother-in-law.
You're making me nervous.
And the bill is, you know, like these things. They try to show the status by, so the MC is Jerry Seinfeld. You've got... I felt sorry for him. He had to come out and do bits, you know, and he said, you know, I just want to take up some of these lyrics with you, Sir Paul. You know, she was just 17. You know what I mean? Well, I think we do know what you mean. You know, that kind of thing. He was having to do those kind of gags in this kind of, you know. So really it put away our, and Paul was actually great. He sat all through rehearsals and watched everybody rehearse, which at least cut down on how horrifying it would be to do it that night know that it
was
really filmed,
encouraging, wasn't he?
He was very encouraging, yeah, because, it, you know, obviously it must have been a big night. He's the center of the attention. And the bill was really wild. It was like Herbie Hancock and Emmylou Harris and the Jonas Brothers and the Foo Fighters.
Terrific.
And Jack White, Faith Hill. And I think I made a good decision. I we're playing mostly, put Stevie Wonder. We're playing. We're playing with Paul's band. He's back. They're backing most people if they didn't do a solo performance. And I did Penny Lane, and I managed to get one of the Marine band to play the trumpet part, because of course they've got one. They've got a trumpet player in a closet.
A glorious touch, that is.
And he knows it.
If you want a piccolo trumpet player, we've got one.
We just happen to have one here. Yeah. It's the president's own Marine band. Yeah. There's a guy, a gentleman called Sergeant Matthew Harding, I believe his name was.
Must have thought this is a dream come true when you did.
Well, it was sort of. I've never been looking forward to being in uniform myself, but my grandfather was a trumpet player, right. So I'm in the army, and so it's sort of, there was something quite emotional about just the whole idea of a guy who'd been trained in that way coming out and doing this. And of course, it's a very legit part. It has to be played. It's not, you're not asking him to play a jazz solo. He's playing that melody that everybody knows. Yeah,
well, it's on YouTube. You can catch up with
him.
We're going to have to wind up, because in fact here we are in the podcast studio of Penguin Books, and I believe in about 2 minutes time Richard E. Grant will be bursting down the door. Talking to you. So look, Elvis, it's a fantastic book. It is called Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. It's absolutely tremendous.
Cheers. And, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.